We have considered your manuscript, and while there are elements of promise, it is not right for us at this time. I felt the weight of my body returning to its depressed state. I slid my hand across the table, grabbing one last envelope. On the front, it had my name. Flinnegan E. Montgomery, 465 Cedar Ridge Lane, Baker City, Oregon, 34652. I opened the letter. To Flinnegan E. Montgomery, from Ed Norton III. Dear Mr. Montgomery, as you have not supplied a contact number or email, I have been forced to send this the old-fashioned way, via postal service. This is one of several attempts at communication, and I remain hopeful it will be received. The concept for a realist novel set in a suburban supermarket and its execution in your initial sample pages are enough to validate what I first saw in you. Great promise. The plotlessness of the work is part of its allure. Anyone can write about mythical worlds, murders, heists, and far-fetched romances. But this mimics how life is lived, in all its boring and profound uneventfulness. I think it will resonate with readers in a special way. The timing is perfect as well. The market has undergone a transformation, and contemporary, edgy, authentic young voices are in high demand. Your work, I believe, has the potential to bring in a large, fresh audience. I believe you are capable of actualizing this story. I have faith in your ability to deliver a dynamic, fully satisfying manuscript. Along those lines, I believe the time has come to meet you in person. Let's talk. I will have my assistant contact you to set up a time for you to come to New York. I look forward to discussing the future of this book and your writing career. Best, Ed Norton III, President, Darjeeling Publishing. I raised my eyes from the letter and stared at the wall in shock. I didn't even remember submitting to this company. Quite honestly, I had never heard of this company. I guess I had nothing to lose. I told my mother about it and she cried with joy. I wanted to turn this opportunity into a life-changing moment. I called the company to set up the meeting. Days later, I was at the airport on my way to New York City. I had never been more than a few hundred miles from home, except the time my mom won a trip to Hawaii, but I was so young I don't really remember much of it. This was the craziest experience of my life. It's insane how someone's fortune can reverse overnight. I'm glad I persevered and kept going through the months of despair. I gave my mom a hug and kiss when she dropped me off at departures. I was flying JetBlue. Going through security was intense. I had to take off my shoes, belt, and jacket. I had to damn near strip down. There was a woman in front of me with a little rat dog in her purse with a bejeweled collar and name tag that said Coco. She was what you would imagine Paris Hilton would look like in her late 40s. Pseudo-rich, fake Louis Vuitton bag, pink velour pants, spray tan, leather skin, plastic nails, and makeup that was caked on. She was acting all crazy, causing a scene, yelling, saying how she was about to miss her flight and had to get to her plane. You know the type. She was the kind of person who felt she was more important than everyone else. As I waited to board, I sat down and pulled out my moleskin. I started writing about the woman, just in case I wanted to base a future character off her. I must have been writing intensely because the guy next to me spoke up. Damn, dude, you're really into whatever the hell you're writing, huh? Oh, yeah, man. I feel like when I have an idea, I've got to write it as quickly as possible because multiple ideas tend to come at once and you don't want to forget that idea or miss out on the others coming at you, he said. Yeah, dude, totally. He extended his hand. My name's Brian. I'm also a writer. Oh, dope, man. I'm Flynn. I shook his hand. What kind of writing do you do? Actually, I write for television, he said. Like drama? Nah, man, I write comedy. I love it, because I just draw inspiration from everyday shit, you know? He took a sip of his coffee. Totally. I feel the same way. Worked on any shows I've seen? I asked. Oh, sure. I've written for Rick and Morty and Arrested Development, and I'm working on a hilarious show right now called Mixed Feelings. It's basically Curb Your Enthusiasm, but about a rapper and all the crazy, hilarious shit that goes on behind the scenes in the music industry. The stuff nobody knows about. Sounds like fun, man. What about you? Brian asked. I'm actually working on my first novel. I'm headed to NYC now to meet with a publishing company. No shit, dude. I'm on that same flight, he said. Oh, cool, man, I replied. What seat are you? He took out his ticket. 23A. No way, what are the odds? I'm 23C. I pity the poor bastard who has to sit between us, he laughed. I had made a buddy in the airport. Maybe this wouldn't be such a bad experience after all. A few minutes later, we boarded the plane. Brian and I made it to our seats, only to find 23B was sitting in my seat. Of course, it was Paris Hilton's skeleton from security. Excuse me, I said. The woman ignored me and fed her dog a treat.
Who's mommy's little prince? She cooed. You are. You are.
The dog began to lick her on the lips as she kissed the dog back. It was disgusting. Any literary description I could give would never be able to do justice to the horrendous sight. Hey, lady, Brian said. You're sitting in my friend's seat. Get the hell up. She turned to us, shocked.
First of all, I'm supposed to be in first class, but my assistant waited to book the ticket until the last minute, and if I'm going to sit in coach, well, I'll be doing it in a window seat. Thank you very much. Ding.
The soothing airplane sound blanketed the cabin before a flight attendant made her announcement.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, she said. JetBlue would like to welcome you to this nonstop flight to New York City.
The announcements continued, and so did the conversation with The Walking Dead's Paris Hilton. Are you fucking kidding me, lady? I said. That's my seat. My buddy Brian here has the aisle. I hate to tell you, but... Wait, no. Actually, I can tell you with great satisfaction. You're in the middle. Now move.
No,
she said, staring out the window. Dude, this lady's crazy, Brian whispered to me. Listen, I said to her. You can't just...
I can do whatever I want,
she yelled, her eyes growing wide like a villainess.
I deserve this seat.
At this point, half of the plane was staring at us. I wanted to choke the woman out, but I obviously wasn't going to do that. Brian, on the other hand, looked like he was going to pop.
Excuse me, what seems to be the problem here? Asked a flight attendant.
Well, this lady...
Nothing is the problem, thank you,
the lady in my seat said.
Okay,
said the flight attendant. Then looked at me.
Well, sir, you're going to have to take your seat.
This lady's in my seat, I said, then explained the situation.
Oh,
said the flight attendant, understanding. She turned to the woman and her dog.
Ma'am, you're going to have to move.
No, I was supposed to be in first class.
The flight attendant was taken aback.
What a bitch,
she said under her breath as she walked toward the front of the plane. A minute later, the captain came back and told the woman she needed to leave or she would be escorted off the plane. That didn't go well. Two officers and a U.S. Air Marshal burst onto the scene, dragging her down the aisle with her little dog, the entire plane clapping and hollering.
I will sue this entire airline, she screamed.
That's when Brian shouted,
You jet blew it!
The entire plane erupted in laughter. Needless to say, it was a flight I'll never forget. I had a tough time sleeping, my mind racing with anxiety about the upcoming meeting, but I focused on my characters, and I eventually slid into a slumber. Brian and I never exchanged info. I kind of wish we had. He was a cool-ass dude. One of those people you remember till the day you die. I peered out the window, overlooking a rapidly approaching metropolis. Butterflies bounced in my stomach. Outside the airport, I jumped in a yellow cab and went straight to Midtown Manhattan. The cabbie dropped me off at 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, not far from the publishing company. I'd never been to New York City, and damn, let me tell you, this shit was wild. I had a bum ask me for change, and a Real Housewives-looking lady shoulder-check me all in a matter of minutes. Pigeons were flapping past my head, cars were honking at me to get the fuck out of the way. This was about as far from my town as you could get in this country. For those of you who have yet to experience New York City, for a first-timer, it's extremely claustrophobic and insanely dirty. I mean big black trash bags just sitting on the side of the street, and everything is loud, fast, and relentless. Half the cab drivers don't know their way around the city and insist you pull up directions on your phone to guide them. But all this aside, I must say, it's a beautiful thing to experience. It's electric. I was happy I made it. A few blocks of a walk and I was in front of Darjeeling Publishing's offices. I checked in, and the next thing I knew, I was being shot up to the 36th floor in an elevator. Mr. Norton's assistant greeted me and ushered me to his office. I sat there nervously waiting for his arrival. His office kind of reminded me of what you see in those Wall Street movies, you know? I gazed over the desk in front of me, peered through the windows into the grand abyss of New York City. I'd never been so high up in a building in my life. On the desk, there were piles of manuscripts stacked high. Books lined the walls, floor to ceiling. At the center of his desk lay a smaller packet, my 20-page proposal that had landed me a ticket to the Big Apple. It had red marks all over the page.
"There he is,"
Mr. Norton said with a big smile as he entered the room behind me. "Hello, Mr. Norton," I said, standing to shake his hand.
"Mr. Norton was my father. Please call me Ed," he insisted.
"Okay, Ed, sure thing," I responded. Ed was a burly man from the South. The accent was clear as day. About 50 years old, he had salt and pepper hair that leaned more toward the salt end, and he wore white jeans, cowboy boots, a white blazer, a turquoise undershirt, a bolo tie, and of course, a white cowboy hat to match. To be honest, he looked like he belonged in Houston, Texas, in the beef business, rather than in the publishing industry.
"Now, son, let's just get down to it, shall we?"
he said in his raspy trucker voice.
"To me, this is an open and shut case. I absolutely love your idea, and if you can deliver, I am prepared to cut you an advance check for $40,000 right now with a back end of $60,000 upon completion of the novel. Of course, in the meantime, you get yourself a new agent to oversee the contracts, but I can guarantee you the royalties and splits will be more than satisfactory. Let me make it clear, though, son. To make this thing real, I need you to deliver this manuscript in 6 months' time, and that's not long. I need this book out next year."
This was when it hit me. Ed definitely was in the right business.
"So what do you say?"
he said. I couldn't believe it. It almost didn't seem real. 2 days ago, I was depressed, sleeping all damn day in my mother's house, unshaven, smelling, and counting sheep next to stacking plates of rotting sandwiches. Today, I was being offered a book deal. Without hesitation, I shook Ed's hand. He gave me some guidance on my proposal and sent me on my way with some books to read and a few encouraging words.
"I know you can do this, son, and do it well. I'm very much looking forward to working together to make this a success. Talk soon."
In a rush of inspired determination, I hurried home without even an afternoon's worth of sightseeing. The next morning, I was on a plane, heading back home to deposit a $40,000 check and get to work. After I hit the bank, I signed a lease on my own apartment. I even went down to the shelter and adopted myself a dog to keep me company. At this juncture, I was single and without too many friends. I was going to need some companionship. He was a little mutt by the name of Bennett, about 3 years old, mainly black with bits of light brown on his face and paws. Sweetest dog you'd ever meet. The day I rescued Bennett, I got him a fresh red collar and took him for a long walk. On our stroll, I asked this random guy to take a picture of Bennett and me on the first day of our new life together. The guy looked at me like I was insane and stared down at the end of the leash, looking bewildered and scared like the dog was going to kill him. He took the picture anyway and then sped off. Really didn't like dogs, I guess. We went home so I could get to business laying the groundwork for my novel. My writing style was like method acting. I got fully immersed in my characters. In an act of radical creativity, I would try to become my characters to make my writing come alive. To pull this novel off, I needed to get inside the supermarket. I needed real-life inspiration. What better way to discover the ins and outs of such a place than to work there? I checked the classifieds for any openings. I saw some help was wanted at the movie theater. That wasn't going to work. I saw an ad for a personal aide to an old man. That wasn't going to work either. And I had no interest in wiping some old guy's ass for him. I was getting desperate. I took a deep breath and looked up. I scoped out the apartment, which was empty. Just a bed, a desk, and stacks of books across my floor. My record player sat next to my bed, spinning with no needle scratching the surface. An old rotary phone with no cord attached to the wall was on my desk. It was more for show, more for the feel, much like my Bluetooth typewriter, which sat on a wobbly old IKEA desk in the corner. I stared at the writing machine. It seemed to have its own personality, an aura even. I was overcome with fear. Fear. That once again, I would not be able to finish what I'd started. That I was a shit writer. That I was a born failure, a loser, a pathetic bum. Fear that Lola was right, that I couldn't deliver for Ed Norton. That I'd have to move back in with my mom. That I'd be 30 with nothing to show for myself. Fear that I would turn out like my absentee father, who wound up a penniless schizophrenic who committed suicide in a psychiatric hospital. I had already lost the only love of my life. If I couldn't do this, if I couldn't give myself that the end with this book, then my life would never truly be my own. I gripped the newspaper, stood up, and walked to the bathroom. I set the paper down next to the sink and splashed my face with water. Just then, the lights flared. I rubbed my eyes and looked in the mirror. There were two of me. My mind felt cloudy. I felt like someone was talking to me. As the other me dissipated, I stared at myself. No matter what happens, finish the book. No matter what happens, finish the book. Stay inspired. Do anything to finish the book. Finish the book. Your life depends on it. I repeated this to myself over and over as the lights flickered. Just finish the book. No matter what happens, finish the book. Repeating my mantra, I began to feel like I was being split in two. Like the old me was out of my body and this new me was here, present and yet not. I couldn't control my thoughts or my body. My head felt as if it were underwater. Flashes of numbness shot down my fingers. The lights flared again and it felt like I could literally see this other me by my side, if only for an instant. I felt terror but also comfort. I rinsed my face once more and looked down at the newspaper next to the sink. Muldoon's Grocery was circled in red. I'd head there in the morning to fill out an application and hopefully get a job that would inspire me to finish this book once and for all. But by now you know I got that job. Now that you're all caught up, we can finish that eureka moment I was having walking with Frank through aisle 9. Chapter 5, Aisle 9.
Are you listening to me? Frank said. You look pretty zoned out right now, and I'm trying to school you with this knowledge. The weird part? Everything he was saying, all the information he was blurting out, I felt like I knew it subconsciously. You see, Frank seemed to always have bits of information, like a walking Snapple cap. Imagine all the shit you learn throughout your life. The things your brain keeps locked. Spelling, family faces, pattern recognition, first hand job under the bleachers freshman year, visual and spatial processing, all stuff for your survival. Then there's the shit you learn, but don't retain. Factoring and linear equations, what you had for breakfast 3 days ago, nutritional information about bananas. Now, Frank, his brain was like entirely subconscious. The shit a normal brain is supposed to throw away, it's like Frank kept it, replacing the main things you need with the clutter of his own subconscious. And that was another unique reason he was perfect for my novel.
Flynn! He yelled.
Oh, sorry, man, I was just thinking about... Oh, no, I thought, stopping myself mid-sentence. I couldn't tell him what I was doing, why I was really here.
Thinking about what?
Asked Frank. If I said more, I would blow my cover as an undercover author, potentially ruining my chances of finishing this book. So I said the first thing that came to mind that was sure to distract him.
Ever fuck that girl?
I asked, pointing to a girl who had apparently been hired a month before.
Who, Kara?
Oh, yeah, man. 2 days in, I polished that off. Kara worked in the coffee shop at the end of the store, the one by aisle 12. Kara was maybe 23, blonde and short, and seemed very sweet. She had piercing eyes, full lips, and hair in a tight ponytail, and she wore brown knee-high boots. Kind of dumb-looking, maybe, like a bimbo who gets by on her looks, but she was intelligent, just naive-seeming.
One of the tightest I slayed in my time here, Frank continued.
Truthfully, I hadn't expected this.
I thought he'd drone on about how he would do her or had planned to, but the fact that he already had, that was crazy to me. Either way, my question distracted him from what had been on my mind, writing this novel. As we walked to the front of the store, he elaborated on their sexcapades, explaining how they went in the back storage area one evening after closing when no one was around. He went on about this little cupcake tattoo just under her left breast, right above her ribcage. I asked him to describe the tattoo, gripping my pen. It was a pink cupcake tattoo with blue sprinkles, he explained, with two cartoon eyes and a smile to match the little arms and legs. By the time I finished writing this down, we'd reached the front customer service area.
How you finding your first day, child?
Rhonda said. It's going pretty all right, I suppose, I replied. Just kind of getting to know the place. At that moment, a door opened behind her. The customer service area was a 10-by-10-foot room. There was an 8-foot-long counter built into the wall that separated Rhonda from the customers who came to her for help. At the end of the counter, where she sat, was a latch that allowed the table to lift up. It was attached to the wall like a drawbridge that could be retracted over a moat leading to the king's castle. In the corner of the room, behind Rhonda, a man walked through, mumbling in Spanish, Hector. Hector was a 34-year-old first-generation Mexican-American security guard at Muldoon's. He was overweight and wore a white short-sleeved button-down, a black tie, and a metal badge on his left breast. His slacks were deep blue with black stripes down the sides, and they were accompanied by a utility belt containing his flashlight, baton, and empty handcuff pouch. It was technically illegal for him to detain anyone. At the end of the day, he had no jurisdiction. Was just a scarecrow Ted Daniels hired at $10.75 an hour to patrol the aisles, scaring teenagers before they mustered the courage to lift something. Hola, Vernon, Hector said to an armed guard who had sneaked past me without my realizing it.
Oh, good, right on time, said Ted, who was walking up right then.
At the end of every month, on the 28th at 4 p.m. sharp, Vernon came to relieve the store of the roughly $100,000 in cash it had made in the month. Until then, it was held securely in a Summerfold safe in Hector's security office, right next to the monitors that displayed a closed-circuit security camera feed. With the exception of a few blind spots, the entire store was covered, not only in the aisles, but outside too, including the front parking lot and back loading dock where Frank took his frequent smoke breaks.
How's your day, Ted? Vernon asked.
He was in his 60s, short and frail for his age, with white hair hiding under his work hat and a bit of a limp in his left leg. His partner, Gary, was the one who drove the armored truck. Gary never left his position.
Well, I'm just fine, Vernon, said Ted.
He smiled, his teeth protruding more than ever. Vernon grabbed the three deposit bags and put them in a locked duffel bag.
See you next month, said Vernon.
Ted and Hector waved goodbye and returned to their daily paperwork.
That guy looked like Father Time, huh? I said to Frank.
Who are you talking to?
Asked Ted.
Frank, I said, turning my head to look. Frank was nowhere to be found.
Well, he must have slipped away while you were standing there daydreaming. No more of that, okay?
Got it, Ted. Sorry about that.
Can I see you in my office? Ted said with a smile.
Sitting in Ted's office was never fun. He was always so awkward. He was the boss who wanted to be everyone's buddy, insisting that you come to him if you ever needed anything. But as he pulled his chair next to mine, the only thing I needed was space, quite honestly.
Flynn, he said, looking concerned, how are we feeling today? You've been acting a little aloof lately. Everything all right? Things going smoothly? Anything you need, just know that I'm here.
No, everything's going pretty okay, thanks, I said.
He was right. I was aloof, but that was only because I was preoccupied trying to take mental notes for my book. If I wasn't floating or being distracted by Frank, I was plotting the story in my head, thinking of how these characters would puzzle together, trying to figure out the rising action and climax.
All right, then. Well, listen. I just want you to know that you're a part of this family now, and if there's anything I can help you with, you let me know, he said with a smile. Oh, he continued, the code to the break room is 34652, okay?
That's the code to everything else around this place. I made it something super easy I would never forget. I mean, everything is pretty much unlocked or open anyway, but, you know, just in case, he explained, pointing at me with one brow raised as if to say, in case you were wondering.
I wasn't.
Like that, I was out of his office as quickly as I had entered, with one thought on my mind. I hope this doesn't become a reoccurring thing. From the corner of my eye, I caught the clock on the wall. It was 6 p.m. My shift was over. The day had flown by. I was feeling more comfortable with how things operated, but I was still a little disoriented. I clocked out and said bye to Rhonda. Just as I was leaving, Frank stopped me.
Flynn, where are you going? He said.
I'm going home, man. It's 6, I said.
You're not doing it right, dog,
he said, pulling out a stack of 20s and 10s from his pocket.
Frank, where'd you get that cash? I said.
Where do you think, Einstein? From the fucking cash register, he jeered.
Frank, what the fuck, man? You can't be stealing like that. That's embezzlement, I said.
Bro, I've been tipping myself out nightly for months and no one has said shit. It's easy as pie, he said as he took out a banana from his apron.
That ain't right, man. Your luck is gonna run out one of these days, I said.
I turned and went home. I got home and poured the day into my moleskin. It may not have seemed like an eventful shift from the looks of it, but it was the kind of pedestrian, humdrum non-action I needed to set the stage for the first few chapters. I wrote and wrote and wrote until my hands hurt. I turned a page, pausing momentarily, mentally dazed from the stream. I turned my notebook sideways and scrawled in all caps, Muldoons. That was it. That would be the title. It was a rare moment of certainty. I closed the book and went to bed. The next morning, when I came to work, I saw the old black man outside playing chess again. This was already feeling like deja vu. As I entered through the automatic doors and walked toward the break room to clock in, I saw the crazy-looking dude holding his coffee to his nose. He sniffed intensely.
Coffee, 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 he said.
Hey, what's your name, man? I asked.
Coffee? Coffee, 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 he said.
Okay, then, I said and just kept walking until I was intercepted by Anne from the pharmacy. Like clockwork, yet again, she handed me a couple of multivitamins, which I pretended to ingest secretly, storing them in my jacket pocket. I reached the break room and hit the keypad above the doorknob, 34652. I went to clock in. Rachel and Becca were sitting inside again, talking about last night's episode of The Bachelor.
Hey, Flynn, Rachel said.
Hey, Rachel, what's up?
I responded as I opened my locker and put on my Muldoon's apron and name tag.
Nothing much, just another monotonous day in the grocery store, she said, taking a sip of coffee. Her bright red lipstick stained the paper cup.
Before I had even a chance to respond, I heard it.
Floater to bakery? Floater to bakery, please.
The voice of a woman with a Russian accent crackled through the static of the dated intercom. On my way to the bakery, the lights went out in half the store.
What the hell? I said, stopping in my tracks.
Oh, that's just the busted-ass electrical system, a voice said from behind me.
When I turned around, I was met by a black man in his late 20s.
You Flynn, right?
Yeah, that's me.
I'm Day-Day.
He extended his hand and I shook it.
Nice to meet you, man.
Yeah, Ted's cheap ass still ain't put the money he should into the electrical system.
Day-Day, I soon learned, was the on-call super for the store, the all-around handyman. Day-Day actually seemed like a chill dude, one of the only employees I could say that about so far.
Yeah, man, he continued. The lights in this place are always shady. Never really know when they're gonna go out on you. This white nigga's so cheap.
White nigga? I thought to myself. What the hell does that mean? I mean, I couldn't exactly just ask him what white nigga meant because as a white man, I'm pretty sure he would beat the shit out of me. Rightfully so. White people have no reason to use that word. But maybe white niggas do?
I guess this is something that I'll never be able to understand about lingo and black culture as a white kid. Hell, I'd like to think that I'm a pretty good writer, but I can't dance for shit. And let's be real, black people have soul. There are just some things that people won't ever understand. As for me, the oxymoron of white nigga is one I shall never uncover. Okay, well, thanks, Day-Day. It was nice to meet you, I said, beginning to walk away. All right, my nigga, I'm gonna get back to fixing these lights. I was so puzzled. Now he called me nigga? What the hell was going on? Was that a good thing? I contemplated this all the way to the bakery, which was located in the back of the store near aisle 13. The bakery smelled amazing. All around were pastries, fresh loaves of bread, cookies, muffins, cakes, and bagels. I felt transported by the aroma. Hey there, Flynn, right? And this is how I met Mia Torres. She was an absolute beauty. A 25-year-old Spanish-speaking, tan-skinned, 5'6 supermarket model with jet black hair and an amazing body. A warm, welcoming energy and a radiating smile. She was the only thing in the entire store that felt real. She was a combination of Jessica Alba and Rashida Jones. Random mixture, I know, but damn, she was gorgeous. Mia was the kind of girl who you would see and feel an instant attraction to and chemistry with. I felt light on my feet. I was infatuated, love-struck. She was wifey material. I realized I had just been standing there silently. I fumbled. Yeah, second day, I said, nervously reaching for my moleskin. Oh, yay, you haven't been tainted yet, she said with a chuckle, giving me an infectious smile. This place is kind of a killer of dreams. Why do you say that? I asked, eager to take micro notes of key points of our conversation. Well, for starters, the... She was interrupted by a tiny, pasty white woman with a face that rested in anger. She was like a 5'4" female Robert De Niro, dressed in all white, with a flower-stained apron, a rolling pin, and a disgusting hairy mole above her lip. She opened her mouth to speak, but before the first syllable slipped out, I knew the voice was going to sound like a creepy James Bond villain. The very same Bond villain who requested my presence in the first place.
Is this Floater?
She said, not really asking either one of us in particular. Yes, I'm Flynn.
You, come with me, Floater.
She interrupted, grabbing my arm. Here I was, being manhandled by a 65-year-old female De Niro, forced into the baker's den. We stood surrounded by freezers, ovens, and huge baking sheets about 3 feet long and 2 feet wide. Counters piled with dough framed the room.
In freezer, we keep dough,
she said in her thick Russian accent. I looked at her name tag. It read Bianca.
Now dough is ready.
She pulled out a box and I realized exactly what she meant. None of the donuts, pretzels, or bagels were made fresh. They were outsourced by another company and kept frozen in white paper boxes. So all you needed to do was pop them in the industrial oven, let them cook, take them out, and put them in a pretty package to give them that baked from scratch look. I spent the next few days in the bakery, and over that time, I learned a lot. Pretty soon, my notepad was almost full. For example, did you know that when anything new is brought onto the floor, such as pies and any other baked goods, they place the freshest on the bottom so as to move the old product first? So whenever you go shopping, be sure to grab your bread from the back or bottom. Aside from the Bond villain trying to kill any bit of happiness I might have, there was always Mia. Our stations were right next to each other. I prepared the bagels and loaves of bread on a countertop, like a buffet table with a sneeze guard, you know? Well, I mean, minus the sneeze guard. To my right was a gap where we could walk out onto the floor, and on the other side of the gap was Mia's station. Mia would man the ovens. We had enough FaceTime that we built a nice little rapport. We would chit-chat, shoot the shit, joke around. She taught me how to bake and ice a cake. This was straight out of an episode of The Bachelor. Contestants having to bake together. Flour was flirtatiously tossed. I really got the feeling she'd taken a liking to me. Mia told me about her ambitions in life and how she had been in college studying law. She explained how her family was extremely poor, how her dad had left her family and was a little crazy. She entered a contest for a full-ride scholarship to law school, had written a moving essay to a man running for governor. In the end, he decided to donate his own money to a good cause, the cause being this brown-skinned poor girl. It was a smart move, playing to the young, lower class, female, and Hispanic vote all in one shot. That's politics. Mia didn't mind knowing this was a big reason she received the ride. All she cared about was the fact that she'd be in school and working toward a career she really cared about. She wanted to be an entertainment attorney. She wasn't really musically inclined, but in the shower, it was showtime at the Apollo for her. She wanted to be behind the talent, representing their interests, making sure they weren't being exploited, and that they were getting their money where it was due. The time we spent together was amazing. I mean, she was the girl next door who you just wanted to spend time with and get to know. Her family situation reminded me a bit of mine. I was attracted to her intelligence, ambition, and perseverance. And for whatever reason, she seemed to want to know more and more about me. I told her everything. Well, almost everything. I told her about my dad, who I never knew. I told her about my aimless youth. I told her about my breakup with Lola and my months of depression. I told her about my ambitions of writing. I told her about how incredible and strong my mother was to have raised me on her own. What I didn't tell her? I was currently writing a book. A book she was now a character in. She smiled when she spoke to me, interested in everything I said. I couldn't help but feel bad for being a little dishonest, for using her for information as research for my novel. But pretty soon, it didn't feel that way anymore. I decided I could ethically keep that to myself for the time being. After only an hour speaking to Mia that first day, I didn't need the notepad anymore. I was hanging on her every word. It was all in my memory. After a while, I realized that the last time I wrote in my moleskin was with Frank. Oh, shit. Frank, I thought to myself as Mia was speaking. By then, I hadn't seen him in a few days and wondered where he had been. And wouldn't you know it? It was kind of a welcome respite, I gotta say. Just then, a lanky arm by the front of the store near aisle one was waving intensely with a banana peel, trying to get my attention. The hand was followed by Frank's head, which popped out from behind the shelf like a cartoon. He motioned me over, but I motioned back that I was working and pointed toward Bianca, Russian villain and sucker of happiness. "Who are you talking to?" Mia said in a why-aren't-you-paying-attention-to-what-I'm-saying tone. "What? Oh, I'm sorry. My buddy was just trying to get my attention." "Oh," she said. "Yeah, sorry about that." Just as I was searching for a further excuse, we were interrupted by a voice.
"Hey there, Muldoon's employees,"
said Ted Daniels, giving us an overzealous wave. He was headed towards the coffee shop with Kara, the full-lipped blonde who worked there.
"Oh, poor girl," Mia said. "Ted is kind of creepy. I'd hate to have to go anywhere with him. And she's so sweet."
"And freaky," I added.
"What?"
"Oh, I just heard she gets a little freaky."
"Who told you that, Flynn?"
"Frank had sex with her."
"Well, Frank is a liar," Mia said, "because Kara is like super Mormon. I've witnessed it firsthand. If she had sex with him, well then, I have a penis."
My eyes glanced down toward the zipper in her pants.
"Flynn,"
she giggled, then smacked my arm. The giggle slap. She was definitely into me. I mean, that's like ninth grade shit right there. I was so in. By lunch, I was pretty tired. Not from speaking to Mia, obviously, but from working hard under the soul sucker Bianca. As I was about to take my break, green-haired Curtis came over awkwardly trying to talk to Mia while I restocked the bagels. Fuck this guy, I thought. As he left, he gave me a menacing look, like he wanted me dead. And as if that weren't bad enough, Bianca would tell us not to speak to each other while we worked. Like, I could totally understand if we weren't being productive or being loud and unprofessional, but our work areas were feet from each other. And this bitch had the balls to tell us, "No talking?" During my break, I snagged a few slices of dead bread from the bakery, and then went to the deli and swiped some honey ham and Swiss cheese when Curtis wasn't looking. An impromptu sandwich. After that, I went to the break room where Frank was filling a paper cup with water from the blue plastic jug.
"Dude, where you been?" he said.
"I could ask you the same thing, man. I haven't seen you in days."
"Bro, didn't you see me today trying to get your attention?" he asked with attitude. "I've been doing that the last few days when that mean bitch who works there wasn't looking."
"Yeah, but I..."
"You were talking to that Mia chick, huh? She's fucking hot, right?"
he interrupted.
"Dude, she doesn't even know who you are,"
I snapped back a bit defensively.
Man, all these hoes know who I am, Frank said, opening a locker and taking out a pack of cigarettes and a lighter. You know, in my locker there's a little cubby under the metal at the base. If you push down on the right side, it pops open. It's where I keep the shit I steal. And my gun. Frank shut the locker.
You don't have a gun in there, I spewed.
What?
It's for when the time comes.
What the hell are you talking about?
I'm foreshadowing, man, he said with a smirk.
Foreshadowing what?
The day some disgruntled, schizophrenic nutjob employee shows up and stalks the aisles with an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, pumping rounds into customers and employees or even himself.
Frank put a cigarette in his mouth.
I'm going to be prepared for that fucker. He's never going to know what hit him. I'm going to be 1,000 moves ahead of him like a game of chess.
You don't really have a gun in there, do you?
I asked. Though deep down, this was the shit I loved about Frank. You kind of didn't know what was real and what wasn't.
Ever seen the roof? He said, ignoring me as he walked past.
No, I have.
Cool, let's go.
As we walked through the store, he continued talking.
You didn't see me because you didn't want to. Just admit it to yourself, man. This really isn't healthy by now. You must realize that.
Wait, what? What are you talking about? I replied.
Mia, man. We were talking about your obsession with her and how it essentially makes me invisible, dude.
What do you mean? I stared at Frank, puzzled.
Bros before hoes, man. But if you want to get technical, the brain is a very complicated organ, man. If you don't control it, it will control you. You see what you want to see. And as the saying goes, you only had eyes for her, I suppose, lover boy. Every time I tried to get at you, I couldn't because you were so focused on this chick, man. Keep your eyes on the prize, bro. In some weird way, it's almost as if Frank was speaking directly to the creative inside me. In a way, he was right. I was so infatuated with this girl that I had completely forgotten why I was there in the first place. To finish my novel. I was smitten, and it had been a major distraction from my book. But Frank couldn't possibly know that.
Eyes on what prize? I asked.
All this fucking pussy laying at your feet, man. You can't get all hot and bothered over one chick.
I paused for a moment near the exit.
Look, man, I said, I'm not here for all this fucking pussy, and I genuinely like Mia.
Chill on how you talk about your coworkers. These women are just trying to make a buck in the summer. Just because you feel the need to try and fuck everything that walks, don't drag me into your gutter.
I like Mia.
So what?
She's old news, man.
Old news? What the fuck is that supposed to mean?
Bro, said Frank, who was now to the right of me. He stopped and put his left hand on my shoulder, like a blind man walking next to a person with sight. I'm just saying this place is like a revolving door. There are new girls in and out of here every day. So if you want to focus on little old Mia, be my guest, brother. But you're missing out.
We walked out the back door and onto the loading dock near the trash and recycling. Frank jumped on top of a giant brown dumpster, reaching for a latch on the ladder that extended to the roof. He released the latch, and the bottom half of the ladder rushed down, stopping about a foot from the ground.
Hustle up, lover boy,
Frank said as he began to climb while holding the cigarette between his lips. I gripped the skinny, rusting bar of the ladder. As I began my ascension, I was quickly winded and realized that, for a skinny guy, I was out of shape. It was peaceful on the roof of the store. Frank pulled out a joint and tried to light it, but the heavy wind blew out the spark.
Ever try to light a joint with a Zippo? It's the fucking worst, he said,
though he eventually lit it and gestured for me to indulge with him. I politely declined with a slight wave.
Who are you, Ted Daniels? Hit the goddamn joint, he said.
Nah, man, that shit makes me paranoid, I told him.
Suit yourself,
Frank said, raising his eyebrows as if to say, more for me.
I'm more of a drinker, if anything, I told him. And honestly, I try my best to stay away from that, seeing as my dad was an alcoholic. Or at least that's what my mom tells me.
She said it brought out his schizophrenic tendencies.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so it's in my blood, you know? Not seeming to care, Frank just stood there looking forward. Our view from the top of Muldoon's faced the back end of the store. It was trees as far as you could see. The sun was starting to set.
I'm going to be remembered forever, Frank said. Immortalized, I can feel it. This is just the start. People will know my name. Maybe it'll be an infamy, but my name will be known.
I pulled out my moleskin to take note of this quote. I found it a bit creepy how sure he was of this. It was even more unsettling because what he was stating was currently happening in my novel. This would be a scene. And with that, we peered into the horizon. Miles out, there were dark clouds punctuated by thunder and lightning. I could feel the storm approaching. Frank's joint had become a roach. He flicked it over the side of the building and reached for a cigarette. He brought it to his lips, lighting the Zippo. Looks like rain. I went home inspired. I paced back and forth in my apartment, chewing on a toothpick, bouncing my red rubber ball. Different ideas, dialogue, and story arcs raced through my head. Thoughts tumbled over one another. They were moving so quickly. Whenever something stuck, I rushed to my typewriter and went to town. The muses were speaking and I was responding. So many things and people, ordinary people I never thought I would meet, having such an impact on me creatively and personally. I stopped to ponder. Fuck the literary world. I wanted to write something I'd want to read. And isn't that what art is about anyway? Expressing yourself the way you want to. Maybe that's why I had been so scared to actually finish and release a book, because of what others would think. You should have done it like this, or you shouldn't do that. A bunch of people, mainly other writers or people who wish they were, reading your work, telling you why it wasn't good enough. So fuck them and their established rules. I'm gonna break every rule unapologetically for my audience. The only people I'm writing this for anyway. I mean, think about it. One doesn't create art for the people who hate it. Plus, when it comes to other writers, if they think it's bad, they'll hate it because to them, it's bad writing. And if it's good, they'll be covetous, wishing they had done it, and consequently, hate on it all the more. So if you're making your art based on others, it's a lose-lose. And if you say, screw everyone, I'm going to make something I love, you'll win every time. It was actually Alan Watts, the late great philosopher, who said simply, anything you can be interested in, you'll find others who are. So this work is for the others, like me. I wrote until 4 a.m. As my eyes grew heavy, my fingers slowed down. My head lowered involuntarily. I was asleep at my desk, using my typewriter for a pillow yet again. Chapter 6. Panic. For the next few weeks it rained. It rained and rained and rained. As dumb as it might sound, Mia was the sunshine through it all. By then, I was about halfway done with the outline of my novel and had even written a few chapters. But I was stuck. I'd been experiencing writer's block because I needed something big. I needed a big event to really fuck shit up, you know? Something the reader absolutely wouldn't see coming. An event to have them holding on to every word, eager to reach the next page, and the next, and so on. Back in the supermarket, things were great, but my time in the bakery was done. That was bittersweet because I missed seeing Mia in the mornings, but I was ecstatic I would no longer be working under Bianca, the sucker of souls. This week I was in the coffee shop with Kara, and Mia was right. She was extremely sweet and super Mormon indeed. But she was also super cute, and I could completely see why Frank had said he had sex with her. As hot as Kara was, my mind was on Mia. I hadn't had sex, let alone made out with someone, in a minute. I sat slouched at the counter with the palm of my hand under my chin, allowing the weight of my head to balance lazily. My mind wandered to visions of kissing Mia, undressing her. Curtis walked by, with his fucking leather wristband, giving me his usual sneer. It was a look of disdain that I was growing tired of. What a clown. That loser would walk around trying to mack on all the girls at the store. None of them wanted anything to do with his bullshittery. Dude probably subsisted off Monster energy drinks, juuling, Doritos, and puddle of mud. His bad energy interrupted my escalating fantasy of Mia. It was a slow day in the coffee shop, and if there weren't customers, there wasn't much to do. I tried to think of something eventful to write about. Writer's block was the worst. If I wasn't creating, I felt static, like a failure. I needed to keep going. I sat daydreaming about possible climaxes. If my book was essentially about nothing, How was I going to bring it to a dramatic resolution? Kara stood idly, scrolling through her phone. This bra is killing me, she said under her breath, adjusting her t-shirt. Being a girl sucks, Flynn. You're so lucky. Flynn? Hey, Flynn! I snapped back to reality. Oh, sorry, what now? I said, only half paying attention. Oh, Flynn, you silly goose. Something is bugging me. Can you watch the front for a sec? She asked, her big blue eyes staring into my soul. Hardly listening, I just nodded, continuing to spitball ideas in my head for something eventful. Something not quite climactic, but pre-climactic. The big bang before the biggest bang. I saw Rachel and Becca walking toward aisle 9. Ted was calling them over to restack a pyramid of canned soup that someone's tyrannical child had decided to push over. Yo, go tell that girl I like her. Frank had popped up from behind the counter, scaring the shit out of me. Fuck, dude, don't do that, man, I yelled. Jesus! You're such a pussy, bro, he replied. Just tell her I like her. What? Who are you talking about? Kat Denning's cousin over there, said Frank. Oh, Rachel? Why don't you go talk to her yourself? Aren't you the self-proclaimed pussy slayer? I need a different approach, man, said Frank, looking at me. Word's getting around I'm a whore. Rightfully so, I said. Look, man, when you can, just tell her I'm into her, okay? Just as I was about to answer, a large white woman with short, thinning red hair appeared. She was wearing a fluffy blue blouse with white flowers, a matching white skirt, and black heels. She cleared her throat in a very authoritative manner. Yes, she said. I would like one medium coffee, black, two sugars, and a piece of iced lemon cake, thank you. I froze, trying to register everything she had said. I looked back to Frank for guidance, but he had gone, most likely sensing the bitchy attitude of this woman and not wanting any part of it. I looked back at her, my mouth open to speak, but nothing came out. Hello, the woman said, loudly and obnoxiously. Can I get some service here? Oh, yes, I responded. Of course. I'm sorry, ma'am. It's just my first day in the department. Well, even on your first day, pouring black coffee isn't too complicated now, is it, honey? What the fuck did you just say to me? I screamed. But before I had time to register what I had just done, I was already balls deep in the commitment of standing up for myself and anyone else this woman has ever made feel inferior. Bitch, what dimension are you from? You think just because I pour coffee for a living, you can talk to me like I'm some piece of shit? You're such a fucking cunt. The woman's jaw was on the floor at this point. She was stunned, fuming with rage. Flynn! I looked up. It was Ted Daniels, screaming my name from across the store. But his scream was nothing compared to the child running from aisle to aisle, kicking over stacks of food. And fuck you too, Ted, I said, my voice pointed straight into his soul. You creepy fuck! Rachel appeared. Her eyebrows were raised high. She let out a quick laugh, then covered her mouth with her hand. I'm here to help you, I said, focusing my attention back on the insulting woman. Not serve you, goddammit! From the corner of my eye, I could now see the kid jumping up and down, smashing plastic bags of tortilla chips with his shoes. And if I were to help you, I would tell your fat ass you don't need the fucking lemon cake. Why don't you give your arteries a break, woman? Damn! At this moment, a child began to cry. The same goddamn child who'd been terrorizing the store for an hour. The child who knocked down the 8-foot towers of canned soup for his own devilish amusement. Listen here, the child's neglectful mother said. I don't know what you think. And you, terrible mom, I interrupted. Put that fucking kid on a leash or I'll strangle that little shit myself. The mother's eyes grew furious. How dare you, she roared. My son is... Without hesitating, I ran over, picked the child up, and threw him through the plate glass window, shattering the Muldoon's logo on the glass, immediately snapping me from... Hello? I said coffee? Black? My daydream. And chop chop, boy, the overweight woman finished. Alas, I thought, another daydream. Okay, sure, sorry, I told her, pouring the coffee so quickly I spilled some on my thumb, burning it. Shit, I said aloud. The pain was excruciating, but I did my best to keep my composure. holding my right thumb under my left armpit as I rang her up using my left hand. The burning intensified with each passing moment.
Boy, aren't we forgetting something? She said.
I had no clue what she was talking about. I just wanted to be away from her and out of the store.
Sorry, what?
I replied.
You forgot my slice of lemon cake.
God damn, I yelled internally, sweat dripping from my brow. I'm sorry, I said, bending down to grab a slice of lemon cake, but as I opened the glass, I saw there were none left. I'm sorry, ma'am, there are none here. My legs went weak. It was a deathly scary feeling.
What do you mean? I'm looking at it right there, she said, pointing to a piece of cake.
No, I'm sorry, that's the display piece, that's not...
Display?
She interrupted.
Well, what about in the back? Surely there...
At that moment, everything around me began to flicker, as though the lights were being sucked from the room, then instantaneously brought back. My hearing became muffled, then ceased altogether. A high-frequency pitch shot into my head, like in those old war movies when a soldier experiences shell shock. Everything seemed to be moving in slow motion and yet super fast at the same time.
I'm sorry, but I've got to get my kids to school here, said another woman in line.
What's the holdup?
Asked a man in a suit with a newspaper under his arm. My chest tightened.
Hello?
The large woman in front of me said. She glanced at my name tag.
Flynn, is it? Well, Flynn, I said there must be some in the back.
She repeated as though I were deaf. My breath became shallow and my neck felt numb. Not sure what was going on, I turned around quickly and walked back into the staff area of the coffee shop. I stumbled through the door like a drunk. I glanced around trying to find a seat. Kara stood in the corner, topless. Topless and fidgeting with the wire in her bra that had been stabbing her side.
Flynn, what are you...
I'm sorry, I yelled, transfixed on her breasts. Her body was incredible. I hadn't seen a naked woman since Lola. The excitement only fueled what I had been experiencing.
I'm so sorry, I yelled. Flynn, get out, she screamed.
And I backed out of the room as fast as I could, repeating the same words to myself.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to,
I stumbled out of the coffee shop. By now, my legs felt as though they would give way at any moment, but I made my way past the line of customers and onto the supermarket floor.
I'm sorry, I continued to repeat, confused in a state of panic. I couldn't understand why my body felt this way, because I wasn't freaking out in my mind. It was my body that felt out of control, as though it were about to shut down. Flynn, a voice said from behind me. Flynn, are you okay?
It was Mia.
I'm sorry,
I whispered to her.
I'm sorry.
I felt dizzy and disoriented.
Just breathe, Flynn, she said, putting her arm around my waist to support me. Flynn, breathe, she said as I slipped from her grip, hitting the cold vinyl floor.
My vision blurred, and then blackness. When I awoke, I was laying in a hospital bed, staring at the ceiling. A monitor beeped to my left. An IV drip ran intravenously into the top of my hand. I had full memory of everything that had happened. I just hoped I didn't have, like, a 6-year-old coma beard or anything. Much to my surprise, it had only been about 45 minutes. Mia was holding my hand and smiling as I came to.
The doctors took blood and urine samples while you were asleep. They ruled out any serious condition, she said. But they are pretty sure what it is.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to know first, what it was or how the hell they got my urine sample.
What do you mean? What is it? I asked. It doesn't sound good.
My fear was extinguished by Mia's laughter.
They think you had a panic attack, she said.
What? What the fuck is that? I asked just as the doctor walked into the room.
Ah, he's awake, the doctor said.
He was a tall black man, maybe 6'4", and skinny. Seeing him, I got that second feeling doctors can give you. You see, doctors only give off two kind of vibes. The first being, I don't give a shit about you, where you come from, or where you're going. My job is to diagnose what's going on and collect a check. And then there are the doctors who genuinely care and want to help people, no matter how many years they've been doing it. My doctor had a warm energy that seemed to convey the latter.
Hi there, Flynn, he said. So it would appear you have had a panic attack. Do you know what that is?
I mean,
I've heard about them, but no, not really, I said. Now tell me, are you prone to anxiety? I had to gather my thoughts. I don't think so, I replied.
Bullshit, Mia snapped.
Yes, doctor, he has severe anxiety, she said with a half